The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Marita Conlon McKenna spoke to me about her new book, The Hungry Road, which is set during the Great Irish Famine and inspired by the true Irish heroes of that time. Aoife Gallagher is undertaking a PhD in childhood bereavement. She told me about her own story of loss and why she has a special interest in this area. Brian Stevenson is an American lawyer who has spent his career helping the poor, the incarcerated and the condemned. Spoke to me about what it was like to take on America's criminal justice system. And Polish filmmaker and former Jehovah's Witness Kamila Dedina talked to me about losing her religion and finding a new identity in Ireland. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy it. At 9:23, what a pleasure to welcome Marita Conlon McKenna into the programme this morning. Welcome, Marita. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me on.
You know, every time I mention your name to people, there's of a certain vintage. They always say, oh, Under the Hawthorn Tree is the most important book I read because it was so informative and so formative for so many school kids in recent times. You must get a lot of love about that.
It's a very special book. It was written with love for my daughter and never intended it to be published at all, only for my family. Then my publisher took it and it has become such a special book to children, not just in Ireland, but across the world. It's used in New York, it's used in Mexico, it's used all over the world. Children are reading it in different languages and it's just become a huge book that keeps going and keeps trucking and people keep reading. One generation reads it, another generation reads it and lots of adults read it.
Yes.
And just love this. It's a very, very simple story told very simply because it was written for my daughter and it's just amazed me what it has done.
It's a gateway type. It's the type of book that's a gateway for children and indeed some adults to history, to learn. And that's what, I mean, you came across, just briefly before we talk about the next phase, but you came across this story about just children buried under a tree and bones. I mean, it's such a grim genesis of a story, but it's not a story that you should be shied away from.
No, it was a little school down the country and they were putting on a football pitch and they were clearing this field to make a football pitch and there was a big hawthorn tree in the middle of it. And obviously they cut down the hawthorn tree and and then they went to take the roots out, a bulldozer came. And when the poor man started to take up the roots, he saw a skull and he saw a bit of a skeleton. And then, unfortunately, there were three skeletons. Man got a terrible fright and the work had to stop. And I was just listening at home and I heard the story and I said, oh my God, that's incredible. And the children used to play in this field and it was the children playing in the field and the children buried not even very deeply underground that had been hidden there for so many years, that just I, small children myself, made this connection with me. And then that night I remember I went to bed and I didn't see skeletons. I saw three children on their feet. Now, admittedly, they were very emaciated and very thin and skeletal looking, but they were alive. And I just felt like a ghost finger saying to me, we want you to write the story.
When you say you saw them, what do you mean?
I actually could picture them in my head. I could see them and I knew they were going to walk. I knew a journey and walking was part of this. And I grew up reading all the classic children's books and a lot of the classic children's books had a journey kind of element to them. Mm. And I just felt these children were going to make a journey and we're going to see things that children should not be seeing really, but they were part of it. And I just took out my pen and I remember the next day at the kitchen table wrote the first chapter. And actually one of my friends lived up the road and I ran up through it at her and said, read and see what you think, because she knew I was writing at the time. I was writing stuff in newspapers and magazines and I'd done a picture book. And if she had said to me, you're mad, don't do it, but she just phoned me and said, please write the next chapter.
You're in. Yeah, you're in.
And I wrote it then. Never intended it to be published. And then when I wrote it then, one or two people read it. And my husband, they kept saying, oh, please send it to a publisher. And then I just sent it to O'Brien Press, who a great Irish publisher.
Of course.
And they took it on and published it.
And so it began. You know, I was talking about this film I went to see called Jojo Rabbit. Now, I'm not sure if you've seen that.
But I haven't.
Okay, so it involves Nazi Germany and it's through the eyes of a child. And
there's
a lot of children coming into the cinema because it's 12A. So see if your kids are under 12, they should be coming. But there were, I wouldn't be very, I'd be inclined to be quite open about it. Ah, bring them in, they'll be fine, they have to learn somehow. But there were a couple of moments in it which involved the punishment at the time would be public hangings.
Yeah.
And you saw the body. I thought, oh, I don't know if under 12s would be up for or to that. So I'd be as in two minds about that. But that's one thing. When you're dealing with dead children dying of hunger and bones and so forth, how sensitive do you have to be? And, you know, this is because you're teaching history. And yet you can't shy away from, as I say, the...
Well, in Under the Hawthorn Tree, I remember I just knew, I mean, instinctively when I started writing the book, three skeletons had been found under a hawthorn tree and I knew a child had to be buried under a hawthorn tree. So the very start of Under the Hawthorn Tree, the three children, Eileen, Michael and Peggy, their little sister, Bridget, dies, she's a baby, and the mother buries her under a hawthorn tree. And I remember, I was thinking, you're mad to put that in a children's book. No one will let anyone read it.
Yeah.
But they did, because I said it would be, how could you ever write about the family and not have people dead? Like, it would be foolish out and really unfair and trying to hide things. And so in the children's book, there is that. Now, obviously, the new book, because an adult book, it's far more, far deeper and far worse, because I can see things through an adult eye rather than a child's eye. So, but you can't hide things that happened. But I think, like, the new book now, I wouldn't like children to read it. Put it this, I wouldn't like, you know, very young children to read it. But I think teenagers would be no problem. But I think you have to be sensitive and in a way that they can take it in and understand it and also get emotionally involved, that it's not distant from them, that they can think about it and talk about it. And I know every class in Ireland who is under the hawthorn tree, there will be discussion about the baby dying. There will be a discussion. The teachers all tell me. The teachers say, oh, I'm very tearful. And the children will talk about it and all the different things they see along the way. You know, they're attacked by dogs and things like that. And there's always a discussion about this. And teachers are brilliant how they approach this kind of writing and history. You know, and history is so important. Our history is so important. I'm mad on history and I just love writing history and want people to, you know, care about history and our history, especially here in Ireland, because we have such a big history, and sometimes we forget about it.
Well, I think that's the danger with the famine story intrigues is the wrong word, but I find it so fascinating in that it seems to have been not forgotten, in fairness, but I don't think we'll ever understand or fathom the enormity of it.
It's I think when you talk about a million people dying, a million people emigrating, it's so big, it's very hard to actually take that on board. And the statistics are all there and the lists are all there and the government things are all there. But really when you're a writer, my job as a writer is to take history and put flesh on the bones of it, to make you care about. I can't make you care about a million, but I can make you care about four or five or six or eight people. Yeah. And I can make you care about them. And that's my job as a writer, to do that.
That's right. I mean, you're talking about children in history for a second, and I think about John Boyne, the boy in striped pyjamas, trying to talk about the Holocaust, if you like, in Auschwitz. And then this story, which is the famine story, and you've done this adult book, as you call it, The Hungry Road, is... You know, I've said before, and I believe that the famine was our Holocaust.
It was, yeah.
And I remember talking to the author Philip Sands, who had written about essentially the Nazis and what have you, the Jewish people and so on. And I said to him over a drink once, "Are we allowed to say Holocaust in Ireland about what happened to us?" And he said, "Of course you are." And this is a Jewish man saying, "Of course you are, because you had this unspeakable horror fall upon you as a people." So it's not to be disrespectful to anyone else to call it that, but it was. When you have a million, like that exodus then of people fleeing the country. But I still don't think we have this. We have processed the enormity of it. Still,
yeah, I think. Well, I always call it the Great Hunger, the Great Famine, you know, because that's what it was. And but I think the enormity of it. But you have to then go into it, like when I did Under the Hawthorn Tree, I was telling the story through three small children, the eyes of them, which it was a more local story. But now the new book, I'm telling it through adult eyes. I'm telling it through the local doctor, the local priest, tenant farmers, families, people of the town. And so you're getting the big picture through adult eyes of the story. And that's the only way you can really take in the story. Mm-hmm. You can have all the statistics in the world, but you have to really care. And if you don't care, you're lost.
You're right. And you bring it local. And yeah. local helps us understand, you know, yeah. micro helps us understand macro.
Yeah.
And with your book, I'm looking at, you know, you bring us into these little, what you, they're not houses, they're sheds and shacks and so on. And especially with the first, you know, few, 50 pages or whatever, the strong men, strong women, sturdy children, and then the descent into yeah. pain and hunger and shame
yeah.
and all of these things that they didn't deserve, but the reduction and the obliteration of humanity.
Yeah. And the book is really, I think, about courage, kindness of good people and the strength of the human spirit. And really writing the book and researching the book, the strength of the human spirit is really what I wanted to capture because, you know, Mary Sullivan, one of the main characters in the book, she's their tenants, small tenants, poor tenants. Mm. And she will fight tooth and nail for her children to survive. And I wanted to show that mothers could do that.
Mm.
And yet the doctor's wife, Henrietta, who they're wealthy, he's the town doctor, she equally will fight to protect her children from what's going on in the town. Well, you know, it's just, and then you have the doctor who, God help him, is thrown into this nightmare scenario yeah. of suddenly thousands invading the town, sick and diseased and trying to get into the workhouse. And, you know, but you know, how people, you know, people think we're all victims, but I wanted to show people fought back.
Yeah.
And I wanted in the book to show they fought back. They, the town people got together and they set up a soup kitchen. And they, long before the government ever did it, in Skibbereen, the people opened a soup kitchen in November 1846, which fed thousands of people every day.
Yeah.
They did it themselves. People came to this old mill from all over West Cork and walked to get the soup. The poor men who were working on the roads were starving and they marched into town trying to riot, but God help them, they hadn't the strength to riot.
Yeah.
But they came in with their shovels and picks, demanding to be paid, demanding food, and, you know, were then put off by just giving biscuits or something to eat. But the fight was there, but in the end, the fight, you know, it was too big a fight for them, you know. But the fight kept there, and the townspeople, the doctor, the priest, the local solicitor, they fought tooth and nail. I mean, the Protestant minister, Reverend Townsend, went over to England and met Charles Trevelyan to ask him for help.
Well,
for
he
their
was
town.
Some creature, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Asked for help.
He thought it was God's will to call lazy
the population.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this, I mean, when you think of the language of that, it makes my yeah. blood boil.
And Daniel O'Connell himself, who has been ignored in Irish history the last few years, that started the book. I wanted to start it on a high point, not on a low point.
Yeah.
And Daniel O'Connell comes to Skibbereen and 80,000 people came to see him.
Yeah.
Skibbereen was booming. It was a booming town, a very wealthy provincial town. And so many people walked that day to see Daniel O'Connell. And Ireland was full of hope. O'Connell was going to get a parliament back in Ireland, going to fight for tenants to get their own rights of their land back. Mm. It wouldn't always be just paying to landlords. And then suddenly, you know, Daniel O'Connell's arrested, things change, and 2 years later, whammy.
When they smell in the wind,
yeah,
the potatoes.
Yeah,
and
it's amazing.
You can almost feel it. Life moves in slow motion.
Yeah.
And then they're into the drills and they're plucking out this yeah. muck and yeah. putrefied yeah. filth and going, we are in some trouble here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, it's breathtakingly upsetting.
Yeah, I found with the research and Dr. Dan Donovan, he was an amazing, the doctor, because he had written this diary of a dispensary doctor, and which you can read, and I was able to read, and he reported every day, even though this man was every day in the dispensary with the sick, in the workhouse where workhouse was so overcrowded, the conditions were terrible there in the end. He was round the lanes, he was dealing with the dead, he was organising pits.
So he was a real person?
He's a real person.
And did you use any of his...
diary in your book? Oh yeah, what he wrote I've used because...
Is that his writing?
Yeah, that's what he said.
Right.
And what he did, most of the stuff he's done is in the book. And I just thought he was this incredible man, a hero, a true hero.
Yeah, yeah.
And what he did, and yet, even though he did it all day, he went out in the middle of the night helping people bury children and little things in their cottages in the middle of nowhere. He got up from his house and went out, and yet came home at night and wrote this diary. And what happened was, his diary then He was a highly intelligent, meticulous man, but really compassionate and caring. And his diary was published in, first of all, in the Cork papers, then in the Irish papers, then was picked up by the Illustrated London News, which is next to the Times in England, was the biggest newspaper at the time, and also picked up by some of the foreign press and the American papers. And this brought attention to what was going on in Ireland. Yeah. This one doctor, the priest was writing, Reverend Townsend was writing, and then there's a very famous artist, James Mahoney.
And he features, so he comes into
comes
the...
He comes in,
yeah,
and he's,
and he's real as well. Oh, my God.
And he came, really, and Dr. Dan showed him around.
Yeah, and he could barely take it because it was just so...
off. And he was sketching. He was a landscape artist. Yeah. Normally, he wasn't, you know, but his paper, you know, had read Dr. Dan's reports, were publishing them, and they said, would he go to Cork and would he meet Dr. Dan and bring him around? So he went, and they are the iconic pictures we see of the famine now that are everywhere. So Dr. Dan showed him around. And just to have these eyes, like the doctor's eyes, the artist's eyes, the priest's eyes, and Mary Sullivan, who probably is the strongest female character I've ever written.
Yeah.
She's a seamstress. She ends up sewing shrouds for the dead in Skibbereen.
And breaking stones.
And breaking stones,
you know, for four pennies. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it is remarkable. And, you know, we were down in Skibbereen a few years ago.
Oh,
and
have you been there? You've
been
there.
And Terry, you probably know from...
The Heritage Centre.
Heritage Centre. And, you know, then more recently we were in Skull and driving through all the places that you mentioned in the book, Union Hall, Ballydehob, Skull, and all beautiful little villages and
picturesque
towns. You're right. And if you, I was reading your book and I was just thinking, I wish I could go back just for a minute to see, so that we could come back then and try and remember it again. But at least we have those diaries that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And that sense of history.
And we have James Mahoney's illustrations.
And the illustrations.
And there's letters from loads of people, different things. You know? Soup kitchen, where the soup kitchen was in the mill in Skibbereen, that's still there. Now it needs to be restored and the talk plans may be restored.
I hope they do.
Because Skibbereen is almost like a monument to the famine.
Right.
That graveyard, Abbey Story, you know, the way out of Skull?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, my mother's buried there.
Is she really?
My mother's family are from Skibbereen.
Yeah.
So she's actually buried, but that is the famine grave.
The mass grave.
Yeah, 9,000 coffinless bodies are buried there. And it's most beautiful, overlooking the river on the way to Skull. It's just absolutely picturesque and beautiful. And you'd never believe that what happened there. But it was a story there for the telling. And I was wondering, why has no one told? I've already done the famine. I don't need to go do it again. Oh my God, mad, bonkers. But then once I started reading his diaries, once I stood in Abbestrury, once I walked the town, and like you said, driving and seeing these abandoned wards, old cottages, that is a story. And as a writer, there's stories for the telling. And if you're lucky, you can grab the story and start to shape it and make it. And it took 3 years to put flesh on those bones because I wanted to do it properly. And my publishers were very good. It should have been out last year or probably even earlier. I didn't, in the end, the contexts were all being ignored. We just went,
no, you did the right thing. Breathe.
Write it.
Do it in your own time. And rather than rush something out, I think that was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
It passes my test of, you know, you've got an hour to read. Great. And I can't wait, as opposed to you better read that. And I'm nearly finished it, but it's eminently readable. But
it's big,
it brings
but it,
you there.
But it's epic. And of course, I don't know if you got yet, but you know, they go to America later on in the book.
I haven't got there yet.
Oh, the famine ship going over. I won't tell you because you've a lot of stuff ahead of you.
No, because I read, obviously, The Star of the Sea would be similar to the, in terms of the ship going across, and that gets that sound. And every time I go to New York, there's a famine memorial there. Do you know it? Between two big buildings. And it is a knockout. If anyone's going to New York, you must go to see it, because New York, Gros Seal in Canada, right back to back over to Australia, and of course across the Irish Sea to the UK. I always say all those Irish bars with bikes on the walls, like, they're not born out of a joyful, strangely, desire to be there. We were forced out because we were starving, and we were one after another shoved onto these boats. Like you described that boat meant for corn, and that's going across. Empty, so the doctor shoves a bunch of people on it politely.
Yeah, the boats went to New York now. The conditions
were
terrible.
Story.
But in the year 1847, Mary Sullivan and her family end up, they're evicted and they go on the ship to New York. But 52,000 people that year landed from Ireland in New York. The population in New York was 340,000. 52,000 people in 1 year went from Ireland. It's a mind-boggling. And 90% of them stayed in New York.
Yeah.
They stayed in New York. So that's how the Irish thing happened in America.
Yeah.
Because that's where they came. And it was really strange. One thing I did find researching the ships, that in one way they thought they had escaped. They were going across the ocean, crossing the Atlantic. And yet the more I read accounts and different things that happened, I felt like the famine was like a ghost and it stepped onto the ship with them.
Yes.
And it followed them across.
Yeah.
Now, some when they got over, the Sullivans were fighters. They were courageous. They were going to survive. But unfortunately, some when they got over, they were so traumatised and that ghost clung to them and they didn't do well in New York. They couldn't lift themselves up. They were the ones that say, oh, they're terrible, the poor Irish, the drunk Irish, whatever in New York. But the majority of them
did raise themselves up. They did. And in the book,
there is a happy ending, I do promise, you know.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to
Don't give it away now.
But it was an epic story to write. And I thought, absolutely bonkers to write the story. But
no, I'm delighted you did, because it got, as I say, it'll get people who are interested in this period of history just back into the zone, if you like. And now already I want to go back to Strokestown to visit the museum there.
Oh, Strokestown is incredible.
Incredible, yeah.
And actually, in Strokestown, 1,400 people were evicted from Strokestown. I was involved in the National Famine Way. It's along the canal.
Yes.
And 1,490 people were evicted from Strokestown and had to walk to Dublin along the canal. On Royal Canal.
Amazing.
They had no shoes, some of them, so they had to actually give them shoes so they could walk. And they got the ships where the custom house is. They got ships from there to Liverpool and then on to America. To Gros Isle.
Yes.
And a huge amount of them died on that journey.
Of course.
I think there were four lots of ships because there were 1,490 and the bailiff walked them. It took them. They went through all those towns. And I was... Strokestown, a National Famine Way, asked me to write a thing for that, which I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And if you walk that way, there's an app, you can go on the site as well. And there was a boy called Daniel Tye and his sister Catherine, and they did that National Famine. They walked that canal and they were one of the few survivors that they survived Gros Isle. Unfortunately, their mother and that died in Gros Isle, and they survived in Canada. And Daniel actually did well later on in Canada, in his generation, his family. And they've come back to Strokestown. So I've been quite involved in Strokestown as well. I don't know, I've just been dragged into the famine, no matter what I do. Yeah,
yeah, well, that's understandable. I was trying to think of was anyone ever recorded on radio, on microphone, talking about the famine experience? In other words, I was going through 1847 and trying to add the decades to see, did anyone make it alive to say, I remember it? Or because it's not that long ago. And when I was reading your book over the weekend, I found myself drawn to, I went on YouTube to find a documentary about the Irish famine. And they began it, this particular documentary began by going to, do you remember Live Aid, Ethiopia?
Yeah.
And that footage. And he was describing the Irish story, but using footage from Ethiopia.
Yeah.
So the bodies, the shrouds,
yeah.
the side of the road, the abandonment. And it was very eerie because you thought, now, because we don't have any footage of this.
Yeah.
So that's why the Quinnipiac
University. Yeah.
That amazing art exhibition.
Yeah, I was involved in that too. It was brilliant.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was essentially, as I remember the lady saying it at the time, that's YouTube. Those paintings are.
Because it wasn't photographs,
exactly.
And they actually have James Mahoney's illustrations. Oh, back on some, have some of them.
That makes perfect sense.
You see, unfortunately, and I've actually, I it's one of my bees in my bonnet, that I wish Ireland had its own collection.
Yeah.
That is a thing I would love to see, Ireland having its own art collection, because some of the artists there in Quinnipiac in the Great Hunger Museum there, they're still alive here in Ireland. John Bee and people like that who've done famine sculpture, Rowan Gillespie. We should have a national collection. That is my belief.
Let's get talking. There should be no reason why we can't, move that along at some point. But because you need more work. Marita, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. We have so much more we could have talked about. We might talk again, because what you've done is a great service, I think, to history.
Thank you so much.
I thoroughly enjoyed this book. I raced through it. I have a bit more left and I can't wait to go back to finish it.
Yeah.
It's called The Hungry Road by Marita Conlon McKenna. The amount of text from people who are reminiscing about under the hawthorn tree, Rebel Sisters, of course, about the Gifford sisters that you put in through. Please tell Marita, my 8th grade class in France, read and study The Wildflower Girl, great favourite of ours from Amanda Harrison, College Jacqueline Duromelie, Manu de Longre in France. Word of thanks to Marita, read The Hawthorn Tree under the hawthorn 30 years ago as an 8-year-old, had a profound effect on me as a child and majorly promoted my interest in history and reading, which remains to this day. So you've great this great legacy. And on it goes. Jennifer says, love lovely to hear Marita. Our teacher read Under the Hawthorn Tree to us in sixth class in 1998. I loved it. I wrote a letter to her in Braille and was so happy to get a lovely letter back answering all my questions. So you keep doing what you do. And thanks for coming to see us today. Good luck with the book.
Thanks so.
Not at all. Marita Colin McKenna joined us on the show this morning. The Hungry Road is the book we've been talking about. And it's a must add to your collection if you're in the bookshops today. Back with more after this. We were contacted quite recently by somebody looking for some help with her PhD, which is just starting. Now, this isn't something we do every day of the week, but Aoife Gallagher's story struck us as being something that was not only interesting, but that might be of help to people listening in this morning, as well as them helping her. And we've invited her in to see us today. Aoife Gallagher, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan.
Thanks for coming
to see us.
Thank you for having me. Not at all. Just a little bit of your own story. You went back to college as a mature student.
As a mature student.
Had you left school early or college early?
No, well, I had done my leave insert and then I'd done a year in Enniskillen doing an early childcare diploma. It was a 2-year course and I left after 1 year at the age of 20 to have my daughter. And then I got a job in the local primary school as a secretary, an SNA and a secretary, which eventually went to just secretarial work.
Okay.
And then I was there for 10 years and I took the plunge to go back to college.
You'd always had an interest in maybe returning to
academia. Always had an interest in returning to early childcare.
Very good. And you had more childcare of your own to look after your first child.
I had indeed. I had my second son in 2003. He's now 16. I had my third in 2009. He is now 10. And I had the baby of the family in 2015.
So busy house.
Busy house. She was 2 weeks old the day I graduated with my undergraduate degree. So
great. And you met your partner, your husband, at an early stage.
Yeah, we were teenage sweethearts, is what you could call us.
Amazing.
We were 15, yes. So we've gone through the good and the bad, ups and the downs together, but we're all still here.
Yeah, good on you. So you went to what university or college did you go to?
I went to the Institute of Technology in Sligo.
In Sligo, yep. And you did your childcare studies.
I'd done
there.
my degree in early childcare and preschool education.
Great, and that's where you wanted to be, isn't that it?
Yes, that's where I always wanted to be, yeah.
Which brings us to the PhD then. This is the bit that where we might be able to help each other in the sense that you wanted to study what aspect of life? Or death, indeed.
Yes, yeah. My PhD is focused on supporting children that have been bereaved when they return to primary school in early years. I suppose my love of research and from personal experience of childhood, of my children being bereaved. Before I went back to college in 2005, Christmas 2005, I lost my brother Fergal at the age of 19 to suicide on the 27th of December. So he was 14 years past just on the 27th of December. They're gone. And
he was how old?
He was 19. He was 4 days short of his 20th birthday. He would have been 20 on the 31st of December.
What a terrible thing to happen.
So it was a bolt out of the blue for us as a family, definitely. Didn't see it coming. Not a phone call you like to get.
And no indication
that
he was...
The morning after St. Stephen's, it's no indication at all. He was going into his final semester in NUI Maynooth, doing his arts degree. He had applied to NUIG for his master's to continue on at master's level. He wanted to get into teaching, secondary school teaching. He got accepted to the master's course a week after he had died. So, he was planning his life. So he went out on St. Stephen's night and he had passed away the next morning.
What a terrible sense of mystery in the sense
mystery
of why did he do such a thing?
Lots of questions and, you know, what sort of suffering was he going through internally that he felt he couldn't open up and talk to us about? So there was lots of questions which will never be answered. But
the questions, I suppose, in some ways is that need to be addressed is for children going, where is our uncle? In your case, they would be asking. Yeah. And is this what sort of piqued your curiosity about bereavement and children?
It is. Well, it was actually in third year. I just finished third year of college. So the summer between third year and fourth year, I applied. I was kind of getting the bug for researching through, you know, assignments and stuff like that. Yeah. So I applied to the HRB, the Health Research Board, for a summer scholarship scheme. It was just a small 12-week scheme to kind of encourage early researchers into the field of research and to kind of try and build their interest and their love for the topics around research and for researching. So I applied for it, and I had to develop my own abstract and my own research study and apply for it. And I was accepted. And one of the lecturers in the college, or there was the head of the School of Social Sciences, of Business and Social Sciences, that actually agreed to be my supervisor at the time, Dr. Perry Scher. And from that little research piece, it was all about finding out what support services are available to people in general that have been bereaved by suicide. Yes. In my local area in Leitrim. And from that, it came that there was actually a limit of support to children under the age of 12.
Yes.
For bereavement supports in general. There was some out there, but there was a limited, you know, there was a limited amount of supports for children under 12. So my undergraduate dissertation then in fourth year, at the end of fourth year, focused on looking at what interventions and supports are available for children under the age of 12. And it identified that, you know, again, there is a lack for even the younger child, like 6 and under.
Because it is such an enormous existential problem for an adult, formed brain.
Yeah.
But for a child to try and comprehend
what
this
happened.
Sudden disappearance of somebody, particularly if it wasn't expected, is enormous. And you had first-hand experience of that, obviously.
Of that,
and how did you deal with that at home in your own house?
It was all quite a blur, actually, you know, but we just got on with it as best we could. We came together as a family and, you know, we actually had to get on with it. I was trying to be as open and as honest as I could. I had two children at the time, a 6-year-old and a 2.5-year-old. And I suppose where the 2.5-year-old wasn't, you know, as in touch with what was actually happening and the fact that his uncle was after dying. He did notice the difference in the routine in the house and the heightened emotions around, you know, about around the situation at the time.
And the 6-year-old?
And the 6-year-old, you know, asked the questions and, of course, was distraught as well. And I suppose at seeing us distraught and, I suppose at the time I didn't really think too much about we just kind of came together, we gave the hugs, we cried together, you know, we'd done it all very naturally. Mm-hmm. But in hindsight then, when I was looking at, you know, when my research was kind of showing the limited supports that were available to children that had been bereaved, I suppose I started to link it into my own experience and to kind of think, yeah, well, you know, when I was going through that, how was I able to support my own children, or how can people support their own children when they're going through such grief themselves?
And you also had the difficulty, I suppose, at the other end of the spectrum, which is your father.
Yeah.
And he had the terrible task of kind of, you know, I think, did he discover your brother?
He didn't know, but no. My brother had been out on St. Stephen's night and my dad had gone in and picked him up after the disco or the nightclub or wherever they were, and brought him home and just went back to bed himself.
So he would have been the last person
to
see him alive.
He was the last person to see him alive, yeah.
And I can't imagine, I always wonder about how a parent buries a child. I just don't understand
how they
as I always say, put one foot in front of the other after this event.
It's an unnatural situation for any parent to be in.
And how was your father in the years after Fergus?
He didn't cope very well. You know, my mother would be more outspoken and talking about it, as we all would be. He didn't. He kind of regressed into himself and internalised his emotions and kind of turned everybody away, very much isolated himself from the people that wanted to be there for him and to help him. He would have developed an unhealthy relationship with alcohol, you know, it would have declined. And he didn't cope. He didn't cope well at all. Following my brother's death, to the extent that 3.5 years after my brother died, he took his own life in the July 2009.
I'm sorry about to hear it, because it's just so awful. And he had been a nurse.
He was a psychiatric nurse by profession. He was, and an excellent psychiatric nurse, as he was a father and a grandfather and a husband. You know, he was very caring. He was very caring to his patients. He always had their best interests at heart. And in later years, he would have worked in residential homes, you know, in community homes with patients. And he would have tried to, you know, make as much as their home and as he possibly could. So he was always their needs and their comforts were always his number one.
But he was tormented.
He was tormented because he just couldn't accept that he had helped so many people in a similar position. You know, out of the depths of despair and suicidal thoughts, and that he didn't see it in his own son, you know. So he was, you know, I think he just couldn't, he couldn't accept that, and he couldn't, he blamed himself.
God help him.
And he just couldn't, he couldn't come to terms with the fact that he had helped so many people in his years of being a psychiatric nurse, and he felt, I suppose, in his own mind maybe, that he had failed his own son.
God, if only they were both alive today.
If only they were
say,
both alive today, too.
Please don't. Yeah. You must think that through in your head. But sure, but unfortunately, to no avail, because the awful news has landed on your doorstep. And then you had, unfortunately, you had to go back to the children and say, listen, it's bad news. And your grandfather and your father is no longer with us. And with that in mind, the kids would have been a bit older at this point.
Would have been a bit older. The two oldest ones, was 10 and... six.
Yeah.
And then my third had was just 4 months old.
Mm-hmm. I meet children sometimes before the toy show.
Yeah.
The day or two before, who we try to mind a bit because they've suffered from bereavement in the family, a young mother, a young father particularly. And a light has gone out behind their eyes. It's the saddest thing. And you just hope that the light comes back.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're dealing with children who are bereaved?
It is, but they are, you know, they put so much honesty into the situation as well. And they have so much, they can help you understand it so much and cope with it so much because they talk about them. We're very open as a family. So, you know, since Daddy and Fergal passed away, they're still in our everyday lives. And, you know, the family has grown since. Like there's been more grandchildren and nieces and nephews and great grandchildren even now at this stage. And you know, those children that weren't even born when Daddy and Fergal passed now talk about them as if they knew them all their life. Such is that we keep their memory alive by you know, keeping talking about them and showing them pictures. And
is that the answer in some ways for families, is not to make anything a secret, to make very much bring it out and emote and talk?
I believe so. And that is my opinion, you know. That I do believe, and it worked for us.
Sure.
I do believe children are very much able to handle the truth, and it's important to be able to tell them the truth appropriate to the age and stage of their development that they're at.
And how do you find that out? How do you know what stage?
Nobody knows their child better than a parent than yourself. So if they ask the question, you're going to tell it to them in an honest manner. You know, relevant to what they are going to be able to understand, and answer the questions that they ask, you know, exactly, you know, just exactly what they have asked, instead of, you don't need to be going into lots of different explanations, or, you know, just ask them what they need to know, because the reality of it is, as they grow and develop, their questions are going to change, their understanding of what has happened is going to change. So they're going to come back with more questions, and they're always going to have questions. And it's the same with us as adults when we're coping with a grief and trying to manage our grief. It's the path we have for life. It's never going to leave us.
Sure.
There's no such thing as getting over it. We have to develop a new normality, and it's going to be with us all the time.
What did you say to your kids when they asked the question, where are they gone?
I suppose because... you know, I was kind of saying, well, they're gone. They were asking, first of all, you know, what happened to them. And I had to explain to them in a child
friendly
way. And I just explained to them that sometimes people have a pain in their heart, or sometimes people, you know, have a pain in their some part of their body that gets sick and they can't be made better. And it was the same with Daddy and Fergal, that they got sick in their minds, and they were not able to get better.
Yeah.
And that was enough information for them
at
the time.
Do you talk about heaven?
We do talk about heaven. We do, because we're of Catholic faith.
Fair
so we
enough.
Do talk about heaven. But it's very important to, you know, I suppose, to explain to children that mightn't be for everybody. So parents will have different ways of being able to remember a loved one, and it doesn't necessarily have to, you know, have be talk about heaven or about lots of, there's lots of different ways. It can be butterflies, it can be white feathers.
Yes, indeed.
It can be dreams, it can be images, it can be the memories that you create yourself.
We've sadly had a lot of talk about grief on this programme in recent times, and a lot of it is, sometimes people say that we're very good at grief in Ireland, that we don't have a stiff upper lip about these things, that we actually do emote and we do wake and we do talk about the deceased. And in your studies, Aoife, have you found that that's the way forward? That's the way to be doing this, is to talk and talk and talk again.
I do believe that it just a problem shared is a problem halved.
Well, it's true. It's true.
And sometimes when the more you talk about something or about someone, and I suppose in my own opinion, I think that just because they're gone and they're not here with us anymore, it doesn't mean that you know, you can't talk about them. Or, and some people aren't comfortable talking about them, talking about somebody that has passed on. Just, and that's just the way they are. And some people, everybody deals with grief differently. And even if you know, they've experienced the same loss. So even myself and my siblings, even though we've experienced the same losses, due to our different makeup, our characteristics, our personalities, you know, our relationships with our brother and our father, our ways of grieving have been completely different. And the same is for children. You know, if siblings that have been bereaved, they're not going to grieve the same way. And I suppose what I would always say is that grief is the price we pay for love. So the more you love somebody, the more deeply you're going to grieve for them.
I mentioned your PhD. Who would you like to contact you, and for what reason?
Well, I have a few different cohorts of participants I'm looking for. I really want to get an overall view of and insight into the needs that are, what is there available already for children that have been bereaved on their return to primary school in early year settings. Because out of the outside of the family home, those are the two places where the majority of children spend the next most amount of time. So I will want to be talking to primary school and early years practitioners and professionals. I would like to speak to experts in the area of childhood bereavement and grief, or even people that deal with children, resilience, mental health, anything that will be able to help me inform and gain knowledge and build a picture of what is there now at the minute and what more needs to be done.
Great. It'd be a great service for people going into the future.
And, I hope so.
And how can people get in touch with you if they...
I have an email address.
Yes, give us an email address there. People, it'd be a very nice service for people if they're inclined to get in touch with you and offer you some of their time, which would be great. And the email address is?
It's Aoife Gallagher, PhD Research at gmail.com.
Okay, and do you want to talk to people who have been bereaved? Is that
part
of it? I
do, yeah. So there'll be people that have been bereaved, adults that have been bereaved in childhood, and I'd like to look at, to be asked, to find out from them what sort of supports were available to them at the time. That they got and that they found helpful or otherwise, and what they would like to have got.
Aoife, good luck with your studies.
Thank you so
much. And thanks for coming in to see us
this
morning. Appreciate
your
time.
Thank you for
having me, Ryan. Not at all. Thank you for your time, and the best to your family.
Thank you.
For 2020 and beyond. And if you find yourself affected by any of the elements of Aoife's story as she's been talking today, you can call the Samaritans on 116 123, or indeed email joe@samaritans.ie. That's joe@samaritans.ie. My guest this morning is an American lawyer who has spent his career helping the poor, the incarcerated and the condemned. And a new film based on his life is being released in cinemas this Friday. It tells the incredible true story of a man who took on America's criminal justice system. And the man at the centre of this story is Brian Stevenson, and he joins us on the programme today. Brian, a very good morning to you, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Could I begin, rather than focusing on the justice system per se, by focusing on your own story for a moment? And I want to ask you about, we all have people in our lives who mean so much. And with that in mind, I'd like to ask you about your grandmother, if I may.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I grew up poor. I grew up in a racially segregated community. And I started my education in a colored school. And there were no high schools for black kids when my dad was a teenager. And when integration came, My grandmother was worried about us. She didn't know that we were prepared for that. And she was an incredibly smart and tactical human being. She was the daughter of people who were enslaved. And my grandmother started doing this thing she hadn't done before. She started coming up to me and giving me these hugs. And she would squeeze me so tightly, I thought she was trying to hurt me. And then she'd see me an hour later, and my grandmother would say, do you still feel me hugging you? And if I said no, she would jump on me again, and she'd hug me some more. And so by the time I was 10, my grandmother taught me every time I would see her, the first thing I would say is, Mama, I always feel you hugging me. And I didn't appreciate what she was doing until I got much older. She worked as a domestic her whole life. She lived into her 90s, but when she got in her 90s, she fell, she broke her hip, and she was diagnosed with cancer. And she was dying, and I was a college student at the time, and I went to see her, and I sat next to her, and I was pouring my heart out. I really did not want to leave her. I couldn't imagine a world without her, and her eyes were closed. I wasn't even sure she could hear what I was saying, but I was holding her hand, just saying all these things, and then I knew it was time to leave. And I stood up to leave, and just before I took a step, my grandmother squeezed my hand, and then she opened her eyes. And she looked at me, and the last thing she ever said to me, she said, Brian, do you still feel me hugging you? And then she said, I want you to know I'm always going to be hugging you. And I have felt the embrace of my grandmother ever since. And she had that kind of presence, that kind of belief in doing hard things, that kind of faith. And that has certainly shaped the kind of work that I do today.
Obviously, a very bright student you were, and you won a full scholarship to Harvard Law School, and then ending up working with the Southern Center for Human Rights. What informs that quest for justice or interest in the justice system, Brian? At what base level for you was it that said, that's the road I'm going down?
Well, as a product of the civil rights movement, you know, I saw that lawyers opened the doors to education for people like me. And I was amazed by that power, because if you had a vote in my community in the 1960s on whether to end racial segregation, you would not have gotten a majority of people to vote for integration. And so I love the power that the law creates to help the disfavored, the excluded, the marginalized. And I wanted to use that power on behalf of other people who were vulnerable. But at base, it was this idea that it's just not right to treat people unfairly. It's not right to treat people unjustly. I went to death row and I met people who were literally dying for legal assistance. And, you know, I just became persuaded that issues like the death penalty can't be resolved by asking, do people deserve to die for the crimes they've committed? I think the threshold question is, do we deserve to kill? And in America, we have a system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. We have a system that is compromised by racial bias. We have a system where there's politics and other forces that undermine reliability. And for me, that became a system that had to be challenged. And it's what brought me into this work.
Do you think African-American history and the African-American story is taught well, properly, or adequately in American schools in 2020?
No, I don't. I don't. I don't think we've even begun to talk about this history. I mean, we are in America still compromised by the smog created by our long history of racial inequality. We're a post-genocide society. Mm. What happened to Native people in America was a genocide. When Europeans came, millions died, yeah. And we haven't talked about that.
Yes.
We instead created this narrative that Native people are savages, and we use that rhetoric to justify that violence. And it was that indifference to racial bigotry that allowed us to tolerate 2.5 centuries of slavery. And the great evil of American slavery wasn't involuntary servitude. It was this idea, this narrative, this false myth that black people aren't the same as white people. Black people aren't as good as white people. And we never really confronted that. We passed the 13th Amendment, but we didn't talk about this ideology of white supremacy. And in that respect, you know, slavery didn't end. It evolved. And then we had 100 years of terrorism where black people were pulled out of their homes. They were lynched. They were beaten. They were drowned. They were tortured. And we don't even acknowledge that today. We had the civil rights era, and still that idea of racial difference persists. And so we haven't really taught this. We've opened a museum in Montgomery. We've opened a memorial. And the number one response we get from our visitors is, I didn't know. I didn't know about these things. So the education challenge is very real.
It's enormous. And even reading around your story, the figure that 4,000 African Americans were lynched in the 12 states of the South from 1877 to 1950, in historic terms, that's last week. And I think that's something that, as somebody who tries to watch history, we don't quite get. You make an intriguing point, Brian, about how it's something that you haven't discussed, and you've talked in the past, and in fact, on this island in Ireland, we have talked about it too, because it we'll get back to that in a moment. But this idea of truth and reconciliation commissions, like they've had in South Africa. Bad history, dark and dangerous. Equally, even Rwanda, which is arguably worse in some respects. But anyway, we go back to the story of America. It's almost like fingers in the ear stuff.
Yeah. I think we have to engage in a more meaningful narrative struggle. And you're right that we haven't talked about it. When we talk about those thousands of Black people who are lynched, but it's even worse because millions of Black people were forced from the American South. 6 million Black people fled the American South in the first half of the 20th century to the North and West. And the Black people that went to Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit and Los Angeles and Oakland didn't go to those communities as immigrants looking for new economic opportunities. They went to those communities as refugees and exiles from terror in the American South. And we haven't acknowledged that. And you're right, you've seen transitional justice in South Africa. Their constitutional court is surrounded by symbols and monuments and memorials designed to make sure people don't forget the injustice of apartheid. When I go to Berlin, I'm struck by how you can't go 200 meters without seeing symbols and stones and monuments that are designed to make sure people remember the horrors of the Holocaust. There's a national memorial to Holocaust victims in Berlin. There are no Adolf Hitler statues in Germany. But in America, in the region where I live, the landscape is littered with the iconography of the defenders and architects of slavery. And we celebrate and romanticize that period of American life. And we still have groups that are defined by these ideas of white supremacy. And when they go onto a college campus, you can't be explaining that away. You cannot be indifferent to the threat that poses. And so we are in this moment where I believe we have to do a better job of confronting this history and commit to the kind of truth-telling. An era of truth and justice is what I think we desperately need.
You say that for every 9 people who have been executed, you've identified 1 innocent person who's been exonerated and released from death row. And you take from that, in aviation, we would never let people fly on airplanes if every 9 planes that took off, out of every 9 planes that took off, 1 would crash.
Yeah.
Stark.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is stark. I mean, for me, that is the problem, though, of the American death penalty. We tolerate error. That it's just intolerable. And I think for me, that's the challenge that we face, I think, all over the world. We're at a time when we have politicians that are preaching the politics of fear and anger. They want us to be afraid and they want us to be angry. And when we allow ourselves to be governed by fear or governed by anger, we tolerate things we shouldn't tolerate. We accept things we shouldn't accept. And in America, we had a generation of politicians that were preaching tough on crime, that were preaching maximum punishment, lock them up, throw away the key, execute everybody. And now we're discovering we've made these horrific mistakes, and we still tolerate those kinds of errors. And that's why telling stories, using every platform we can to create a new relationship to these phenomena is a priority. I mean, I never imagined that, you know, I'd be the subject of a major motion picture, or I'd be talking about a movie, but I'm persuaded that cinema and art can perhaps get us to understand the cost of some of the problems, of some of this inequality and injustice that lectures and data and scholars haven't. And that's why, for me, this becomes an important project.
I appreciate that. And you know, the resonance watching your movie of your story And the African-American story isn't a million miles away in some regards to the Irish story, particularly north of the border or once upon a time here with Catholics in the previous centuries. But and I know that people like John Hume would have looked to the civil rights movement for peaceful protest and so forth. And then we had miscarriages of justice. For example, if the death penalty was in place in the UK in the 70s, we'd have the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four would all be dead men now. They subsequently were all released, having been found innocent of any charges laid on. And that brings me to this idea of miscarriage of justice. That brings me to Walter McMillan. And maybe you could share that story with our listeners, if you wouldn't mind, Brian.
Sure. Walter McMillan is the subject of the film. He was a black man living in Monroeville, Alabama. He was wrongly accused of murdering a young white woman. They actually put him on death row for 15 months before the trial took place. It's the only case I've ever worked on where they actually put the client on death row to coerce him into testifying falsely. The bizarre thing is that when the crime did take place, Mr. McMillan was at his home with dozens of black people. They were raising money for his sister's church, and so they could all account for his whereabouts, and they went to the police and said, "You've got the wrong person," but he was nonetheless convicted, sentenced to life by the jury, but the trial judge overrode the jury's verdict of life and imposed the death penalty, and he spent the next 6 years on death row, inching closer to execution. I got involved in the case and quickly found lots of dramatic evidence of his innocence. The police had actually coerced witnesses to testify falsely and recorded the sessions where they were coercing these witnesses. And so you hear these witnesses saying, "You want me to frame an innocent man for murder, and I don't feel right about that." And the police are saying, "Well, if you don't do what we ask you to do, we'll put you on death row." And so we gathered all of this evidence and ultimately presented it in court. We didn't get relief. But we finally were able to get some relief. The other thing that was ironic about this case is that Mr. McMillan grew up in the community. This case took place in the community where Harper Lee grew up. Mm. And she wrote the beloved novel To Kill a Mockingbird, which is based on this community. Mm. And people in that community love that story. They romanticize it. They name streets after the characters. They have a To Kill a Mockingbird museum. They're very proud of their relationship to Kill a Mockingbird, while they were indifferent to the plight of this black man who was wrongly convicted for the murder of a young white woman. And all of those things were so rich that they became the heart of the book that I wrote, Just Mercy, which is now the film.
Which is now the film. And watching it, I got the sense that where you were at that time, with your client at that time, you as an African-American lawyer defending an African-American on death row probably had to come up with three times, if not more, multiples of evidence to defend your client and to get him released than possibly the average or somebody else on death row, namely a white person.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, we had these tapes where the police had coerced witnesses to testify falsely. We had people who could testify about Mr. McMillan's innocence. We had all of these contradictions in the evidence. We even got the main witnesses who testified against him to recant their trial testimony and admit that it was false. But notwithstanding all of that evidence, the trial judge refused to grant relief. And I do think you're right that we have a system that is very resistant to acknowledging that it made a mistake. It's very tolerant of this kind of inequality. And you meet some of my other clients in the film, a man named Anthony Ray Hinton, who spent 30 years on death row for a crime he didn't commit. And that same dynamic is there. I got death threats when I was working on this case. We got bomb threats. And so it reveals, I think, how important it is that we have a generation of people who are willing to continue fighting, you know, for justice. I was taught that you have to stand up even when people say sit down. You have to speak even when people say be quiet. And I don't think we could have won relief for Walter McMillan or the dozens of other people we've won relief for if we didn't embrace that sentiment that you have to sometimes put yourself in difficult places if you're going to make a difference.
You said, Brian, and we're coming to the end of our conversation, but I wanted to kind of end along the lines of this by saying you've said that 10 years ago you would have said no to a suggestion of making this film. What changed?
Well, I began to realize that I couldn't just stay in the courts, that we were going to have to get outside the court and change the environment outside the court. I just realized that if we don't create a consciousness around the world that justice matters, that equality matters, that fairness matters, we're not going to achieve the things we want to achieve. My work has been defined by a basic belief. I believe that each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I don't think if someone tells a lie, they're just a liar. If someone takes something, they're just a thief. Or even if they kill someone, they're just a killer. And that idea has to be, I think, embraced by a larger segment of the population if we're going to protect fairly the poor, the condemned, the incarcerated. And so I made that choice, and I did a TED Talk, I wrote this book, we're doing this film, and now we're engaged in this narrative work that I think is going to be important if we're going to create the kind of justice that we so desperately need.
In conclusion, there's a sense that the elephant in the room for me in some ways is Donald Trump. So let's bring him in for a moment and let me ask you, do you think he's going to be elected for four more years as your president in November?
You know, it's hard for me to say. I actually think there's a lot of frustration in America right now. We've never seen our government this impulsive and reckless and non-diplomatic. And I think a lot of people are very concerned about that. And so it's my hope that people will get active. I think a lot of people who should have voted didn't vote because they were just indifferent to both of the candidates in 2016. And what I'm urging everybody to recognize is that you have to vote. You don't get to only vote when you have the perfect candidate. I was taught that you have to make a choice between bad and worse, but you make that choice for bad because the survival of some people will turn on it. And so I'm urging people to vote. If they don't want to vote for themselves, vote for the immigrants, the undocumented whose lives are being imperiled. Vote for people whose health will not be secure without adequate care. Vote for the people who are being marginalized. Vote for people who are being mistreated. And if that happens, then I think we'll see change in America's leadership in 2020.
We shall watch with interest. Brian, it's been a pleasure to talk to you this morning. Thank you for your time and good luck in everything you do.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Brian Stevenson is the lawyer at the center of the movie Just Mercy, which is out in cinemas in this country on Friday. It stars Michael B. Jordan, Jamie Foxx, Brie Larson. It offers an intriguing look into the justice system in America, and particularly during a very dark moment, one of many, sadly, in American judicial history. The text number, as always, 51551. My guest this morning is a Polish actress and filmmaker based in Dublin who has a story to tell about what happens when you lose your identity. Her name is Kamila Dedina and she's with us in studio this morning. Kamila, you're so welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Tell us a little bit about life at the beginning for you. What part of the world are you from and what was it like when you were growing up?
I'm originally from Poland. It's a small town that I come from in the south of Poland. It's set in the mountains and it's a type of place where everybody knows everybody. It's a very small community. It was a fairly standard kind of Polish upbringing, if you will, when I was growing up.
The place you grew up in, your mother was doing what for a living at when you were little?
She was a hairdresser. She was a very successful hairdresser. She had her own salon. And
she was a great mother, obviously. And
she was, yes.
And doing all those things. Your father, a little more tricky.
That is correct.
Right, tell me about him.
My dad, God bless his soul, if I may say so, was an alcoholic ever since I remember. So when we were growing up, he never held a proper job. When he was sober, he loved my mom and me and my sister to bits, and he was amazing. When he was drunk, he, you know, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, typical kind of scenario. When he was drinking, he would get violent, particularly verbally, in terms of like emotional abuse, but occasionally my mom was subject to kind of physical violence, is the way to call it, as well. So yeah, it was certainly never boring.
lots happening all the time. Your family then would have been, like so many Polish people, Catholic, religion-wise.
Yes, although we were never particularly devoted, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, of course I do, yeah.
We would show up, I think the last time I was in church personally was when I was five. But, you know, my mom and my family would be, I mean, my mom and my dad wouldn't be very practicing. The other part of my family would be very, very Catholic.
Okay, but it was in the ether, as it were.
Certainly, yeah.
And with that in mind, there would have been you know, regular knocks on the door from the other religion coming to say hello and tell me about that.
Jehovah's Witnesses, yeah. Yes. Actually, the main way I think my mom met Jehovah's Witnesses, or the main channel, if you will, was through her work as a hairdresser. She had clients that were Jehovah's Witnesses over the years, and they sort of plant, you know, regularly would plant that seed and leave some literature and also knock on the doors eventually as well. I think it was a many years long process that they would sort of approach my mom over time, and gradually that seed that they planted grew.
Which brings you to when you were about 10 and the meeting started to become come into your life.
Apparently, I was the one who would like drag or encourage my mom to go to the meetings, even if she wasn't feeling like, you know, she would come from work and be tired, and I was the one on to her. Come on, mom, we're going to a meeting. I think the reason for that was I was getting a lot of attention from Jehovah's Witnesses as a kid. I was very articulate and I was kind of smiley and, I don't know, cheerful, and I think they just loved it. And I very quickly discovered that dependency. If I was, you know, nice, if I was attentive, if I was engaged with Jehovah's Witnesses in a meeting or in my Bible study, they would show me a huge amount of attention and love and appreciation. And it was like an absolute drug.
Can I ask you a little bit about the Jehovah's Witness religion?
Sure.
Because I know little or nothing about it. Obviously, I know that they knock on doors. They're always very pleasant. But I really have never investigated. What are the big beliefs there versus compared to the Catholic Church, for example, given that you know both?
Jehovah's Witnesses believe that we do live in the last days of what they call the system of things, which is basically the current state of affairs in the world. And okay, they believe that Armageddon, which is an apocalyptic, terrible war, if you will, between God and the rest of the world, is coming imminently. The dominant mindset of a Jehovah's Witness is centered around obedience to Jehovah, who they think is basically God. But anything that Jehovah says, quote unquote, is distilled and distributed through the governing body of Jehovah's Witnesses, which is basically like a board.
Board of directors.
Of directors, if you will. Although they would never call that, you know, they would never use that.
No, but as a metaphor.
Yeah, it's about seven people in New York City who run Jehovah's Witnesses from the headquarters. So all the minuscule or countless, if you will, rules that regulate the life of a Jehovah's Witness come from there, through those people, through the literature that they distribute around the world.
The knocking on the doors then, is that part of their religious mission?
Oh, it's the core of, you could nearly say it's the core of their religious mission, in so much as they believe they need to save as many people as they can before the Armageddon comes. So the idea is, basically, anyone who isn't a Jehovah's Witnesses, be it a child or an adult or a person of any sort of, mm-hmm, you know, state, will die if they don't become a Jehovah's Witness.
Okay.
So the preaching, the proselytizing, knocking on doors, has at its purpose saving people's lives. That's the way Jehovah's Witnesses see it, and that's why they're so, you know, adamant and persistent at it, because it's.
It's their belief.
It's their belief.
If you believe that strongly, that's what you want to do.
Exactly.
So when you were getting a little older, into your teens, for example, you were going to your regular school as well as being part of the Jehovah Witness family, if you like.
That's right.
And how did you feel compared to your other classmates, for example?
Very quickly, you know, as a Jehovah's Witness, I developed a sense of superiority, which is, I think it's common to many witnesses over other people. So it gives you a huge psychological reward when you feel better than other people. And even if, you know, you don't make as many friends or you feel kind of awkward in school because you're, you know, you don't celebrate this, that or the other, you still feel better.
Why?
Because you're chosen by God. You're a member of the one true religion.
Like an elite.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very much so, like an elite. And it feels great, you know.
Okay, okay.
The secondary school was amazing because I made very close friends in my class with girls that weren't Jehovah's Witnesses, but they were very arty. They had a band and I became their manager, quote unquote, because I would have wanted to sing, but it wasn't something you'd really be allowed as a Jehovah's Witness. It would have been very much frowned upon. So I became their manager and by proxy I was able to, you know, participate in that arty life. The secondary school was the first time I started feeling a bit, maybe there was something off about the religion, but it was very, it was so subtle. It was, you know, nearly unnoticeable. The university was where everything basically fell apart.
And before you go there, before we go to university, I want to ask you a little bit about things like, I'm intrigued by the baptism ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Could you paint the picture for us about that? How old were you and where do you go for such an occasion?
I was 13, and typically when you get baptized as a Jehovah's Witness, it happens at a annual assembly, which is basically like a congregation meeting, except it's multiple congregations. So it can be anything from, like, I don't know, 500 people present to, you know, 8 or 10,000 or more. You'd go to typically a sports stadium that's rented for the occasion. So my baptism took place in Wrocław at a sports pitch during a summer congregation. So, you know, it's blasting heat. The pitch, the green part?
Yeah, the pitch.
You set a portable swimming pool, small, like, you know, kind of the size of this table here. Sure. And people basically line up in a queue, in modest swimsuits, very importantly. And elders from the congregation stand in the water, and they wear like a t-shirt and shorts. And one by one, when your turn comes, you step up to, or, you know, step into the pool, and you get immersed underwater briefly. That's the story.
tell me, as you were getting into your teens and as your involvement in the Jehovah's Witness was continuing, what was your father saying?
At the early kind of stages of us getting with Jehovah's Witnesses, I know my dad was very opposed to it. And especially when he was drunk, he would, like, make a scene. He would tear the literature apart and cause a terrible kerfuffle. The thing that he did, because, you know, he would read some of those magazines and very quickly grasp the basic ideas. And one of the basic ideas is that the wives should obey their husbands, and they're, you know, inferior to their husbands. And
right.
It's very patriarchal way of life.
I see.
So he held on to that, and he would give out to my mom and me as well in time that we weren't, you know, treating him well. We weren't obedient, and we weren't, you know.
Wasn't he smart enough to pick what he needed from the literature, you know, in his sober moment, and then use it against you in an angry moment?
He certainly was clever that. So there was that initially, but, and, you know, it was tough, but with time, because he had a stint in prison when I was about 10 or 11 for emotional abuse of the family. He was jailed for 6 months. And after that, he kind of, I think he noticed that my mom did indeed change a bit as a Jehovah's Witness, and maybe became less, you know, they were at each other's throats less.
Okay. So the daughter of an alcoholic. I do understand that. It's a line that I think a lot of people listening in will understand this morning for sure.
How did
the Jehovah's Witness feel about third level education?
Well, as a kind of a baseline or default behavior, they wouldn't encourage it, and they would frown upon it.
Okay.
And that's because you're basically, you're encouraged to style your life or shape your life in a way that allows you to devote maximum possible amount of time to preaching, to being an exemplary Jehovah's Witness, to going to meetings, to preparing for meetings, to reading the Bible, to praying and all that stuff. And ideally, your job will be non-demanding, you know, part-time if you can help it. But
menial.
Menial, ideally, yes. Just so it doesn't, you know, definitely not a career that's all-consuming. You know, it conflicts with your life.
Okay, so you're clearly extremely bright and, you know, questioning, and yet you are a little indoctrinated by your religious upbringing. How do you deal with the demands of Jehovah's Witness and that family versus the demands of your own loyalty to yourself and your intellect?
Well, oh goodness.
It's a battle, isn't it?
When you ask it like that, I'm suddenly thinking, Jesus, I had a tough. Well, you know what? I think in secondary school, so, you know, those years when your personality as an adult is kind of really shaping between 15 and 19, I actually had an amazing group of friends, both in my secondary school who weren't Jehovah's Witnesses, and friends from the congregation who were just as devoted as me, Jehovah's Witnesses. And I had a very strong sense of belonging and a sense of community with both of those groups. I don't know how I managed not to lose my mind, because they were, you know, they were conflicting and they were tearing me in opposite directions. But somehow, I couldn't tell you how I did it. I just remember I had a great time. The 4 years of secondary school were one of the best times in my life.
And did you make a decision, an executive decision, in your own mind to leave the Jehovah's Witness, or was it a gradual process?
It was very much a gradual process, and it came years later when I was, you know, at university. When I did go to university, that's when that question you ask, you know, my own sort of identity, my own needs as a human being, my intellectual needs, my emotional needs, started really banging on the door inside me and demanding attention, you know. So the way it manifested itself was basically I became horrifically depressed when I was kind of at my first year at university.
Why?
I think it was mostly because I was plucked out from a safe environment and dropped in an empty space, and just felt really lonely. And I think that's how it started, you know, that I just, the loneliness and the lack of my normal routine and my community that I was used to made me just feel very alienated. And then that's when being a Jehovah's Witness became really, you know, jarring, when I was as a peer among other students, people who were basically adults, and they had very, you know, set worldviews. I just kind of remember realizing that I know nothing. I know nothing about politics. I know nothing about economy. I'm kind of stupid and, you know, ignorant and lost.
How do you leave the Jehovah's Witness in a way that isn't very difficult?
Great. There isn't a way to leave Jehovah's Witnesses that isn't extremely difficult.
So what did you do?
For me, that process took years. It took at least, I think, 3 or 4, maybe 5 years even. It was, I compare it to the process of, you know, water eroding the bottom of a river. It's just almost imperceptibly slow. And the reason for that is, now, mind you, I don't know that every single Jehovah's Witnesses experiences it as deeply as I did when I was leaving. But I think a lot do. Being a Jehovah's Witness for me was in my DNA. It was who I was. It was everything, you know, it was running through my veins, if you will. So separating myself from that identity was... I like movies, so I, you know, like those 80s gory horrors, like The Fly. You know when Jeff Goldblum transforms into a fly and like he's got things like breaking and sprouting through and they break his skin and they pop out and it's loud and disgusting and painful and full of awful things, mentally and emotionally. That's how it felt. I'm laughing, but it was really actually harrowing. You know, it's just so many years have passed that I look at the, I suppose, brighter sides of it. But it was an experience of animal terror where over time, I just, you know, I followed emotions as my way of exiting the religion rather than intellect.
So if you say it was a time of animal terror, what was terrifying you?
Not knowing what was going to happen to me, not knowing who I was, not knowing what I want, not knowing anything about anything. That's how it felt, you know?
And your Jehovah family, did they become aware that you were leaving, you were drifting? And if so, how did they cope with it and how did they deal with you?
You know, the way it manifested for me, it was I just stopped being a super engaged Jehovah's Witness. I stopped being going to, you know, to service or preaching to other people all the time. I stopped going to meetings. And if I did go, I was just kind of sitting in the background like a mannequin. And what I experienced as a reaction was somebody called it, interestingly, preemptive shunning, which is... Jehovah's Witnesses practice this thing, you know, it's safe to make friends with other Jehovah's Witnesses, obviously, and that's what you should do, but only if they are exemplary Jehovah's Witnesses. If they express any sort of doubts about the religion, then they are huge, there's a huge red light or a flag around them. Don't go near them. Better not associate with them because, you know, they're dodged. They can change your mind about God and you don't want that. So you, what I experienced was just, I lost my friends. Most of them turned away from me and they wouldn't, you know, speak to me. They started ignoring me, which was my guide in exiting the religion ultimately.
So even if you were in a room looking at these people who were formerly your friends, were you... Do they look away from you?
Do they pretend
you didn't exist?
They just wouldn't kind of come up to you and have a chat or express any interest in how you are. And like not every single one of my friends behaves that way, by the way, but majority, you know. It's kind of like distancing yourself. The contrast was so huge between how I was treated when I was, you know, giving it socks and then I wasn't giving it socks and I was, you know, suddenly invisible. So that was my guide in exiting, in the sense of, this is how I noticed that something is really wrong.
I get the sense, though, that rather than them being mean or necessarily cruel, I get the sense that, if to use a modern sort of expression, they were ghosting you.
Absolutely.
You know, almost quietly saying, we're done.
That's
Is that it? So it's not a really mean get out and you know, I hear of other religions where they can haunt you.
No. Definitely it would be passive, kind of like ghosting, like you said. The Jehovah's Witnesses would never really actively lash out anyway, because their religion kind of...
So when you went down that garden path from the front door of the church, metaphorically, and you got down the garden path, which was weaving through briars and bushes and all sorts of things, you got to the gate, you get out of the gate, you close it behind you and you breathe, you're out. How did that feel?
That moment when being out started feeling good, that came even later. Initially, just being out was I felt like I was going to die, you know. But eventually, I suppose, you know, day by day, the freedom of being able to do whatever I wanted, or taking up any job I wanted, or reading any book I wanted, or watching any movie I wanted, and so on, that was exhilarating.
I'm intrigued by the fact that, as a movie lover, the reason that you, as a Polish person, find yourself living in Ireland in 2020 comes from a movie you saw as a 14-year-old. And imagine the impact. Little did you think, watching this film at the age of 14, where the roads would lead. It's crazy. Tell us about the movie and why you loved it so much.
Well, I was incredibly romantic when I was, you know, an adolescent girl. And my sister had a VHS tape of Braveheart by Mel Gibson. And one rainy afternoon, I remember putting it on and I didn't know anything about it before watching it. And I was incredibly swept away by the story, obviously. Cried my eyes out. It was so intense and riveting and beautiful, but also the landscapes. At the time, I don't think I knew it was Ireland. I was just like thinking, oh my God, Scotland is so beautiful. And then when I went to university years later and I sort of had my first regular access to internet in a library there, I Googled it, you know, the making of the film, and I learned, it's actually Ireland, where, you know, the Wicklow Mountains, where it was mostly shot, or you know, to a large extent. And I do remember in that moment deciding that I wanted to live in Ireland because it is the most beautiful country in the entire world, and magical and you know, stunning. And that was, that's the reason I'm here.
If you hadn't Googled, you'd probably be in Scotland now talking to some guy on a radio.
In Edinburgh. I wouldn't be surprised, yeah.
But here you are, you did, and you got your flight from Poland and you came to Dublin. You worked in a coffee shop for a while, and you worked in an office for a little while trying to find your way. And ultimately, you realized, you know, it was acting, it was movies, it was you've been peppering our conversation with talk of movies and so forth. That's where you wanted to be. So what do you do now?
I'm a filmmaker.
Yes.
So I'm working on my third film at the moment. I'm also an actress, mostly theatre. My latest film project is called Debutante, and it's a short narrative drama which explores the world of Jehovah's Witnesses. So it's this time in my life when I'm ready to sort of take that on. Mm. In a way that I very much intend to be respectful and compassionate towards the members of the religion, while also discussing or showing the impact of very overbearing religious control and shunning on an impact of a teenager.
Because
on on the life of a teenager.
On the life of a teenager, I understand. Mm-hmm. If I understand your relationship with the Jehovah's Witness isn't one based on any animosity necessarily. It's just more curiosity, or at least that sense of wondering why it has to be so.
Yes, it's a form of, I think, in making this film, it's a form of reconciliation for me. I feel like I have a lot to say about what I think is difficult and hurtful inside that organization, and the film is my creative way of expressing that, of dealing with that, for myself as much as for the public kind of benefit, if you will. But it definitely isn't meant to be like a propaganda film. Jehovah's Witnesses are bad people.
Yeah,
it's none of that.
It's an exploration rather than
exactly.
So how many years are you living here now, Camila?
12 and a half, I think.
12 and a half years. Yeah. And are you happy that you made the move to Ireland?
Oh, God, yeah. I love it here. To be honest with you, Dublin has felt like home for many years. I have only really experienced good times here in terms of like people I met and adventures, if you will, and work to a large degree as well. The people that I met, the Irish people, they're just super friendly. And I feel like we have a lot in common in the way we look at things. I like the Irish sort of, not cynicism, but this kind of dry humor, when you talk about things. Because I'd be naturally very excited and I'm like very energized and sort of, I can be a lot to take. And over time, I sort of absorbed this Irish kind of less is more. And I like that. You know?
Okay.
So I'm
okay.
Trying to learn that. Anyway.
Well, I'm delighted that you're here and enriching the country with what you do. And we'll put a link on our website to all the details for your film, Debutante. Thank you for giving us such an intriguing insight into your world. I've really enjoyed our conversation this morning. So thank you so much. And good luck to you with whatever you do.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Camila Dedina joining us on the programme this morning. The text number is always 51551.